Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. $15 billion on the table in Washington for Detroit and plans for a car czar to set straight an industry that's come begging. Congress calls it a bridge loan. But a bridge to what? And who's driving if we go this way? This hour on Point, when Washington takes the wheel, we're looking at billions, a car czar, and Detroit. You can join the conversation. Can the government do what Detroit could not? Steer this American industry to glory or at least survival? Are you ready to throw the keys and the cost to Washington? Joining me first today from Detroit is Neil Baudette, Detroit Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. Neil, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
So as we speak, what's the status? Agreement in principle? We hear in the news at the top of the hour more than that now. What kind of timetable might this actually happen today?
I think the chances are probably less than 50-50 that it happens today. It could. The House is going to go first. If they have a quick debate and a quick vote, it could be on to the Senate, but it looks like the Senate would go tomorrow. But you're looking at this week, they'll have some deal for the government to put basically $15 billion into GM and Chrysler. Ford wouldn't be taking money in this round. And then they'd get some oversight from a so-called car czar.
Now, that oversight, I guess, is the subject of the negotiations that have gone down to the wire here. What have the sticking points been? The White House is generally on board, but there's been some pushback on the car czar's powers.
Yes, that's correct. The car czar has been one of the points that held up things between the congressional Democrats and the White House. And the big question is, how much power does this car czar have? At one point early on, they were talking about this czar being able to halt any payments by these companies of $25 million or more, which could really turn into micromanaging. I mean, these are companies that spend $100 million a day. In the end, it looks like the car czar will be able to step in and stop payments or expenses of $100 million or more.
But this so-called czar is supposed to knock heads and put Detroit on a new path if, in March, they're expected to go off and do great things. I mean, they're not just to watch, right?
That's correct. It really should be somebody, a fairly hard-nosed individual who doesn't have... has an understanding of large corporations and perhaps the auto industry, but doesn't have great sympathy for them, because there really are some very tough choices here. GM is going to have to close some of its brands, and you wouldn't want to see any backsliding or backtracking from that.
So there's so many questions here. One, your colleague Greg Hitt raised in the Wall Street Journal, at least in an early version of this, the government would receive stock warrants for its loan, at least 20% to the value of at least 20% of what it loans here. GM is talking about getting $10 billion. Its entire market capitalization at this point is only $3 billion. Is the government going to end up owning GM, a majority share, a huge share of GM at the end of this?
Yes, well, I think, you know, if it all works out very well, it could, and the government probably should. Now, remember, in the 1979 bailout of Chrysler, the government took warrants in that company and ended up making money on the deal. There's no reason why the government shouldn't get warrants in these companies, so that their stock is very beaten down these days. If they recover, the stock price will go up, and the government can profit from its investment, just as any other investor would expect.
But unless I've got the numbers wrong on the back of a napkin here, we're talking about a potential majority share. I mean, is this in effect the nationalization of GM at least?
I wouldn't say in effect. Yeah, well, a quasi-nationalization in a way. The automakers would dispute that, and I think people in Congress would object to the term nationalization, but that's the way a lot of people see it, that this is the government essentially taking a stake in these companies. This is not all that unusual. I mean, the government did take a large chunk of AIG, the insurance company, mm-hmm. that got into trouble and has bought stakes in troubled banks. So this is not really out of the ordinary.
But it's pretty out of the ordinary in the sense, I mean, when Japan did anything like this years back, our government would scream bloody murder. And here we're talking about by March, some kind of turnaround plan. We hear Nancy Pelosi today saying, you know, there's a chance to restructure here. They'll be responsible to the taxpayers. Is there a path that in a handful of months can put Detroit on some kind of road to this vaunted viability that in all these decades it wasn't able to achieve on its own, Neil?
Well, you know, there were many reasons. Blame goes to the unions, management, and government for why Detroit was on this path for so long. You have to recall that going back to the late 60s, there was a tariff on pickup trucks, which essentially created a profit-protected segment of the market.
Which included SUVs.
Yes, mm-hmm. and where the big three could make huge margins on the products they sold there. So naturally, that's where they put all of their effort. Then came the CAFE fuel regulations, fuel economy regulations, that had some stipulations about cars being made in the U.S., and it made it difficult for the American manufacturers to make money on cars here, so they put very little resources into those. And that's not the only reason, but those are two interesting reasons why you have this situation today where these three companies are so heavily dependent on trucks and are really in a very weak market position in automobiles. So it goes back years and years.
Mm-hmm.
The question of what can they do by March 31st, that's a big task. I mean, they need to come up with some restructuring plans and get them in place in just a matter of months. It's a big job, but, you know, this is a battle for survival, and they'll have to find some way of doing it.
Are people assuming that after that 3 months the car czar would continue to oversee Detroit, or is it just give us a plan in March and you're on your own, or is March a time for the hat to come out again? I mean, we've heard already about a total of maybe 34 or 38 billion, way beyond the 15, people throwing around numbers much bigger than that.
No, the idea is that they get this initial injection of cash, and then there would have to be follow-on money, or there are likely to be follow-on money. I don't think this first round of money is enough to carry them through. So they'll get this money to get them through the first quarter, and once President Obama is in office and the new Congress is in place, then they'll have to go back and talk to the car czar and get a plan, a longer-term plan for saving the industry.
Wow, the government right in the middle of things sounds like a marriage that could last a long time. Happy marriage or not, I have no idea. But Neil Baudette, thanks for laying out the fundamentals for us, Neil.
Real pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
Neil Baudette with the Wall Street Journal, the Detroit bureau chief for the Journal. Joining me right now from Philadelphia is John Paul McDuffie. He's associate professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, co-director of the International Motor Vehicle Program at MIT. John Paul McDuffie, thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure.
Can this work? Can Washington reach in, name a car czar, put some billions on the table, and somehow magically in a handful of months or even years have this viable industry that seems to have eluded this country for such a long time?
Well, you know, Tom, I don't think this is the path anyone would choose in normal economic times, and we're really here because I think Chapter 11 wouldn't work as it normally does. I think in normal times, Chapter 11 might be the way to go. So a government loan with a lot of conditions, as opposed to a heavily government-facilitated bankruptcy, I think ends up being not so different financially. The idea is to simulate the best of a bankruptcy process without the formal process. And so proposals, instead of going to a bankruptcy judge, will now come to this car czar. But it certainly brings us to this moment of a lot of government involvement in the policy for firms and industries, and we don't have a lot of precedents for that.
But it seems mystifying. Is there some brilliant man or woman out there who's been hoarding the secret for how GM and Chrysler, maybe Ford, should succeed? Rick Wagner and everybody else couldn't figure it out, but now a car czar will step forward and with the wisdom of Solomon see what's to be done here? Or is there, am I missing the point? Is there some dynamic here that will just naturally rise up to take these companies to a success we haven't seen them attain in years?
Yeah. Well, so I don't think the Karzai role is brilliant insight. Actually, it's going to be more one of monitoring the conditions on the plan, being tough about not doling out further funds until targets are reached or until a plan is convincing. There is a premise here, which I'll admit is the proof will ultimately be in what happens as the hopefully the economy improves, that these companies were starting to do a lot of the right things, to deal with their cost structure through a big breakthrough contract with the UAW in 2007, shifting their product mix towards fuel-efficient vehicles, among others. And then they got hit by the financial crisis and the credit crunch. So I mean, by and large, that was the message of the CEOs during their first visit to Washington. You know, not our fault. We're doing the right things. Give us the money. We'll make it through. Mm. That was rejected. But that's at least still part of the story, the assumption that there are some good things happening. Then I think the issue is, can the government nudge and push through the leverage of the loan some behaviors that perhaps need to be taken more fully, and also to get all the parties to agree to some sacrifices to get to a better situation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the Karzai plan and Washington moving into the driver's seat of the U.S. auto industry with Detroit. On Capitol Hill on Monday, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said it's necessary to loan money to struggling automakers.
The jobs of millions of American workers are at stake, along with the financial security of millions of families. So while we take no satisfaction in loaning taxpayer money to these companies, we know it must be done.
The White House saying it's agreed in principle to a rescue package, but Republicans still resisting. Earlier this week, Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama warned here against bailing out the sinking ship.
Once you start putting money in a sinking company, as any banker will tell you, they refer to it as putting good money after bad. The more money you put into a corporation, the deeper they got you. You're the one that is hooked. You're the one that's stuck now.
We've been joined from Philadelphia by John Paul McDuffie, co-director of the International Motor Vehicle Program at MIT, associate professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania there. We're joined now from Washington also by David Rothkopf, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, author of Superclass. He was deputy undersecretary of commerce for international trade policy in the Clinton administration. David Rothkopf, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What are we headed into here? If this passes in roughly the shape, and as we speak, it hasn't, but if it makes it through, where are we headed with this?
Well, I think, you know, we're headed into a case study on how not to manage a crisis. You know, you've got a bailout-burdened auto. You've got a loss-burdened auto industry that's now turning to the creators of some of the biggest deficits in history to manage their business. And, you know, instead of the bridge loan to nowhere that Barack Obama was talking about, we've got a bridge loan to another bridge loan, because nothing's going to happen that is going to be transformational in the next 3 months when this is an industry, or at least this is a segment of an industry that couldn't get its act together for decades. And I think that, you know, history and logic and any even cursory analysis of this situation will lead one to conclude that this is going to end in tears.
On the other hand, turn it the other way, $700 billion for Wall Street banks with almost no strings attached, and that happened comparatively in the blink of an eye. You know, a lot of people are saying, what's this? You're going to wade in up to your chin for Wall Street, but not for this big industry that employs so many people, David?
Well, I think using the Wall Street bailout as you know, as a justification, when the Wall Street bailout was largely, you know, unjustifiable, ill-considered, and was kind of a Washington panic in reaction to a market panic, is probably not the most compelling argument to make. You know, within the Wall Street bailout, there are some useful lessons. Not necessarily useful precedents. And one of the useful lessons is that when you throw money at a situation without changing the behaviors that caused the situation, you're not going to actually fix anything. And in this particular case, although there are strings attached to this in the sense that there is government oversight, we are still not at the point of changing the behaviors that have gotten these companies into this place. And we're also at a watershed in terms of things like our energy policy, where you could end up with the government owning a big chunk of the auto industry and having somebody from the government sitting in a room where somebody else is doing infrastructure rebuilding or energy infrastructure rebuilding, and they are completely at odds in terms of what they want.
The fossil fuel factory against this other green future that Obama talks about.
Well, yeah, some guy is going to sit there and say, let's build light rail. And your auto czar is going to be sitting there saying, well, how about building
how
light
do I
rail
sell
in
cars?
5 years? Yeah, exactly.
hang on, David Rothkopf. John Paul McDuffie, you know, help us here. Because on the other hand, to see all these jobs go away, there is a real warning out there that we could slip right on down into genuine depression here. And it's a lot of families and a lot of paychecks. And if there were a way to fix this and put it into some new orbit, who wouldn't want that? Can you see that possibility here?
So let me start, Tom, with part of how I think about this, which is to look at the worst case of this loan.
Okay.
And I think even possibly the other loan that probably will follow in the early part of 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say it doesn't work. What we might end up doing is eventually having a bankruptcy. My own view has been for a GM, for example, what might start as Chapter 11 with a lot of government funds would very likely end up with liquidation. If that happens and we can postpone the impact of that on the economy by some period of time until the economy is in better shape to handle it, I think that there are massive advantages in that. Don't kid yourself. Most of the costs of dealing with a bankruptcy would fall on the government anyway. Some have argued in much larger amounts than these loans, whether it's the debtor-in-possession financing that gets the bankruptcy process started, whether it's the unemployment, health care, and pension claims that would roll over to the government. So let's imagine that worst case happens, this postponement happens. The government is first in line to get repaid on this loan, and all you need to imagine is that, let's say, General Motors has at least $15 billion or more in assets at liquidation to pay the government back. To me, that's an acceptable risk, given as you said, the potentially devastating consequences of having this make the economy much worse right now.
So you're saying worst case, even if it's just a temporary life raft, even if 6, 9 months, a year from now, it all goes to bankruptcy filing anyway, it would have been worth it?
Yep.
Okay. Is there a better scenario than that?
Well, of course, and nobody's hoping for the worst case. It just puts things in perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, a lot of this has to be about getting the industry to the right size. It's something that they have resisted. There's a whole series of reasons why they've wanted to keep their volumes high, and it's part of helping them sustain their fixed costs, for example. But these companies are way too large, and already the plan submitted to Congress talk about cutting brands, cutting dealers, closing factories. I think those targets could be made more aggressive, and there could be more teeth in the government conditions for having that happen. When you take out brands, there's a whole set of products you don't any longer need to develop. That reduces the number of dealers you need. It's got to be a much smaller industry to be sustainable. I think the government could give a very good, healthy push in that direction, which the companies have already started to do.
All right. David Rothkopf, there's a couple of paths which John Paul McDuffie says look better than just letting it, fall into bloody hell right now. And one of them may be sustainable. What do you say?
Well, I mean, it is conceivable that we could end up with a sustainable path, but it's going to be a much smaller industry, as was just noted, and that means that a lot of jobs are going to be lost.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that one of the rationales here for not going into bankruptcy was, who's going to buy a car from a bankrupt company? Well, who's going to buy a car from a company that you don't know what's going to happen in 3, 4, 6, 8 months anyway? So I think that the market signal to buyers of cars has already been sent, the one that you don't want to have sent. I also think that, you know, there's a fallacy built into this thing when we keep referring to the threat to the industry. You know, there is an auto industry in the United States mm-hmm. that is doing okay. The workers in that industry work for Toyota, Honda, Nissan, BMW, and other profitable auto companies that operate on a global scale and have done so much more successfully and are weathering the current very tough economic conditions much more successfully here. Beyond this, you know, you've got another problem that's built into this whole thing, which is, you know, the bailing out of a company, Chrysler, which is owned by a private equity firm
mm-hmm.
that, you know, made a bet on this thing, made a bad bet on this thing. And so, you know,
the government is in effect helping guarantee their return, their private return on that bet,
or protecting some return mm-hmm. in any event. Now, you know, does that mean we should let this all, you know, go to hell? No, I don't think that we should. But I think the first thing we ought to do is figure out, what is our goal here? Is our goal here to preserve jobs? If so, perhaps there are ways to spend this money that can protect those workers better than this plan. And the other is, do we want to preserve a certain kind of manufacturing capacity? Well, very small portions of this have defense implications. That should be preserved in all likelihood. But the question is, what kind of manufacturing capacity? Is it a greener auto industry? Is this part of the rebirth of the American transportation sector? Well, if that's the case, perhaps what we ought to be focusing on are things like a gas tax or a cap and trade system that sets mm-hmm. a price level for carbon that changes behavior, new standards, and push America to actually lead the world in things like CAFE standards and produce cars that can be sold in other parts of the world that have much higher standards at scale, as opposed to the way that things are currently working.
But who's going to lead all that? Let's turn to our listeners for a moment. Scott in Worcester, Massachusetts. Scott, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, mm-hmm. Mr. Ashbrook. You need first of all, the auto industry, it's absolutely essential. They must be bailed out. It's a no-brainer. If they go under, the U.S. economy will go into a depression. We're really in a depression now. We'll go into a deeper depression. We need a Henry Ford of the 21st century. I recommend Lee Iacocca if he's up to the job.
He's a little creaky. I mean, God bless him, but he's getting up there now.
He knows more about the – you need somebody with three essentials. They got to be brilliant. Know the car industry. They have to be tough, and they have to be ruthless. Rick Wagoner, his problem is he's too lovey-dovey with the union. The unions have destroyed not only GM, all of Ford, Chrysler. The unions have to be put down. They have to
put down. They put a lot of meals on the table.
I understand that, but what I mean put, they need to be relegated where they're not suffocating the auto industry. If Mr. Iacocca can't do it, if for whatever reason, you need to go to a school like MIT or Harvard. You need to get a man who's absolutely brilliant in industrial whatever and put him in charge. Otherwise, we're going to go into a depression.
The best and the brightest, you say. Well, we'll see. We'll pick it up, Scott. Hang on. Let's get a call from Tim in Newton, Massachusetts. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, my heart goes out to the auto workers and their families, but I really don't believe these companies should be bailed out. You know, take, for instance, GM. You know, I looked on the EPA website and saw that they make 34 different models of SUVs, 125 different configurations, over 8 brands, averaging about 18 miles per gallon.
Mm.
Now, can you imagine the lack of planning and leadership that these workers are toiling under? You know, not only are their jobs hard and it's difficult to put meals on the table, but then to be led by this slow motion car crash that is GM. My comments are three. One, could a czar be the type of person who is able to intelligently cut the number of brands needed to get the good product out?
Okay. Yep.
Two, put together the small design teams that would be required to actually build intelligent products.
Yeah.
And three, I challenge your guest from the Wall Street Journal, please review what these car companies are currently making. I would love to know what the last 3 months' output has been.
You mean what kind of vehicles?
Yeah, exactly. I bet they're still building SUVs as we speak.
And out they go, out the door. Tim, thanks very much for your call. Let's go first, if we may, to Karzar Identity and who that might be. John Paul McDuffie, you know, a caller says, get Leah Akoka back in there, or somebody brilliant, tough, and ruthless. Who do you see on the horizon? And do you anticipate they're really going to have that whip-cracking power, whoever it is, to knock heads and redesign this industry?
So if they give this person the power to control the release of funds in a phased way, mm-hmm. That's a pretty big power to kind of focus attention.
That's a chokehold.
Yeah. I think probably the skills that are most needed are the, you know, getting the parties around the table to all make concessions and all contribute to the solution. So that means not only the automakers and not only the union, but also suppliers and dealers. Looking at the financing side of this, the auto company finance arms, and to some degree the finance industry, the creditors or the debt holders. I certainly think industry knowledge is going to be needed to get these conditions right, but I think that could be more advisory to the czar if that person has this kind of ability to, yes, be tough-minded, but also sort of oversee a process in which these parties are brought together. The one thing that President-elect Obama has said is that he wanted the industry as a whole to bring a plan for how they would be sustainable into the future. So far, we've seen a plan from the automakers. We haven't really heard much from anyone else, and the automakers quite visibly haven't been galvanizing those other players into making the plan.
David Rothkopf, have you heard a name that says to you, ooh, he or she could make this work, even if it's not ideal? Can you imagine somebody in that seat, in these shoes, who could do it, whatever it is?
Well, the names that come to mind mostly come from fiction, because I really have a hard time coming up with somebody who's got all the skills that are necessary. I can tell you one thing, though, that the idea that's been promulgated by Nancy Pelosi and some others that this ought to be somebody primarily with public sector experience is, you know, ludicrous. The skill set that is needed here is a business skill set, and you need somebody who actually is able to understand what's possible to within the context of these companies and within the context of this industry. I don't think that it's simply a gray head, but you know, there's a further problem with this approach, and mm-hmm. that is that if you have a government-appointed czar,
right.
That person is going to be more exposed to political pressure, and that's going to color the nature of the decisions that this person makes if they are dependent on the government,
of course.
For their employment.
I mean, I understand so George Bush would appoint the first one, then Obama could put somebody else in there. But either way, as you say, it's a political appointment. That means political pressure.
Well, right. And, you know, if the labor unions start getting uncomfortable with the deals, they're not going to just take that discussion to the table. They're going to take it via the back door into the Oval Office or into Nancy Pelosi's office or whatever. And, you know, that's why had we gone to a prepackaged bankruptcy and then moved from that into an independently appointed administrator who operates at the behest of the court, I think we would have probably ended up with a better solution among all the not very good solutions that are out there.
How many billions do you think we might be talking about before it's all said and done here, David?
If it's anything under 40 or 50 billion, I would be shocked.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Karzar plan and Washington moving into the driver's seat of the U.S. auto industry with Detroit. We've been joined by John Paul McDuffie, co-director of the International Motor Vehicle Program at MIT. He's now at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. And David Rothkopf is here, author of Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. He's a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, was Deputy Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade Policy in the Clinton administration. On Sunday, President-elect Obama spoke with Tom Brokaw on Meet the Press. He said that helping automakers was necessary, but that, nationalizing, in effect, the U.S. auto industry is not the answer.
We don't want government to run companies. Generally, government historically hasn't done that very well. What we want...
Not to run the companies, but to run the terms.
What we do need is, if taxpayer money is at stake, which it appears may be the case, we want to make sure that it is conditioned on a auto industry emerging at the end of the process that actually works.
That actually works. President-elect Barack Obama on Sunday. John Paul McDuffie, isn't this, though, in effect? If it goes through pretty much as planned here, isn't it, in effect, the government running the companies? If the cars are, is the last word, as you say, the chokehold on the money, isn't he or she, in effect, like the board of directors, the boss?
I think it depends on a couple of things. First of all, how much is this the cars are in the oversight role, approving or disapproving things that are brought by the companies as proposals? And the second question is, how long does this go on? To me, if it would resemble the role of a bankruptcy judge much more if it's ruling up and down on proposals, and if there's a clear sense that, you know, points of time, if targets aren't met, that the loans get called in, I think it limits the role.
I mean, I just have the question, the sense that Detroit just hasn't had the knack for making the leap into this new era of mobility, whatever that's going to be. Maybe it won't look like old cars at all. David Rothkopf says if you don't change behavior, you don't finally change the industry. Is the capacity for an all-new U.S. auto industry out there somewhere just over the horizon, John Paul, or is that always going to stay just over the horizon?
I mean, there's certainly some innovations coming in both in technology and in business models. This Israeli company is getting a lot of attention with its idea of having a national infrastructure of recharging stations where people can bring their plug-in hybrids and quickly exchange batteries to get a fully charged one. And
Israeli, great, but we're talking about the U.S.
True. So I guess what I'm saying in terms of the real breakthrough innovation that gets us to the next era of mobility, I think those breakthroughs will come not from these big companies for the most part. I expect them to be followers in that area rather than leaders. But the goals of shifting the country's cars on the road to more fuel-efficient models, whether they're traditional engines or all these new kinds of drivetrains, I think there is a role for government policy to nudge behavior in that direction. It's got to be coordinated, though, with some other things that the government has control over. And so I don't see bankruptcy as being a very good place to advance some of these coordinated policies, and it's possibly a bit easier here. You know, set a higher CAFE standard as a condition for the loan. That's in the legislation. But rather than simply have the companies forced to buy vehicles that may not be purchased, do something with energy policy as well, maybe a floor under gasoline prices so that provides a stable incentive for both consumer purchase decisions and for company product decisions.
Seems like an industry that needs a revolution, and you just wonder whether government oversight can produce that. David, I want to come to you on that, but we've got so many callers here. Robert in Bethel, Vermont. You're on the air, Robert.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you. Well, listening to everyone, I don't think the government nor Detroit have a clue on how to remedy the situation. I think the whole conversation is almost absurd with regards to Nancy Pelosi and Barney Frank and the guys down there making huge decisions like this.
But what are they supposed to do? I mean, the stakes, everybody tells us, are enormous, Robert.
Well, they are enormous, but we now, even without the financial debacle, the car industry was in major trouble before this even happened. Now they're holding us hostage with laying off all these millions of employees. Well, this was going to happen anyway to the car industry. And now they're saying if we lay these people off, oh, my God, the whole country's going to go down because we can't lay these people off. We have to keep these people working. Well, let me just go on to another point here. With regards to the car czar, I think it should be a commission, not one person. And maybe it's made up by a Toyota or a Honda executive. but, truly, I don't think that the government, I think it's a joke. I think it's $100 billion minimally. I think if any economist really looked at this, it's not $15 billion coming up right today or tomorrow. It's not 34. It's, I believe, three times that. And I guarantee you, this car czar will have no control over those monies. And lastly, I think that the heads of each one of the companies should be taken out, and this should be treated like a professional takeover of a company where new blood is put in. Wagner should go. They should all go.
Rick Wagner et al. Out the door.
Out the door. I think they all should go out the door. Mr. Chrysler is a Home Depot ex-executive CEO.
Nardelli, yeah.
What does he know about the car industry? So I think as a package, if Washington is going to put this whole thing together and create a car czar commission, the number one contingency is the head of each one of those companies should go.
Robert, let me get another call, and we'll look at that. Anita in Waterloo, Iowa. Anita, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, what do you know?
Well, I've been listening to this kind of play out, the whole bailout thing for the auto industry, and I guess I don't think it's going to help anybody. I think I kind of agree with your listener before that it could be, you know, $100 billion before they're back on their feet. But the real problem is Americans don't have credit to buy these cars. Even if we bail them out, it doesn't help the actual economy. It just helps one company. I think it's a, I don't think that it'll work. And I think we're going to end up spending a lot more than we're anticipating, especially if we get a car czar. So then we'll have interest invested in these this company or these companies already that were failing before and will continue to fail until the whole economy is boosted. I think the money should go to the people, frankly. If you're going to do anything, give it to people so they can actually go buy cars to save the industry.
Just throw it out of an airplane instead, maybe. And Anita, thanks for your call. David Rothkopf, you're listening to all this. And a couple of things that come to my mind from this. One is this word revolution. People talk about this industry needing that. John Paul McDuffie points to some Israeli innovation. But what about here in this country? And then the whole idea of a essentially nationalized industry or an industry where, as Anita says, you know, the government ends up fully kind of vested in it. And you point out the contradictions in that. I mean, are we ready culturally to understand how to even do this, how to have government get its mitts on a great big industry like this and have the wherewithal to bring to bear in a car czar or a commission to know what to do with it? And can you make revolution out of a, because everybody's talking about the green challenge right in front of us, out of a setup like that?
Well, look, you know, I mean, we're clearly in a panic situation here on all of these bailouts where the mantra is, you know, ready, fire, aim. We ought to think, and when we think, we ought to think about what it is that government is able to do well. There are ways government could foster a revolution here, and one that would have benefits economically, benefits in terms of environmental policy, and benefits in terms of national security policy, and that is change our approach to the way we tax the use of carbon in the United States. Government is good at that. If you are concerned, as the woman listener was a moment ago, about the inability of American consumers to get credit, why not create loan guarantees or tax incentives to get people to go out and buy the kind of cars we want them to buy, cars that have, you know, very high efficiency standards. Let's focus on the transformation that is in the public interest, because that's what the public sector is supposed to be doing. And, you know, there was a reference earlier to Shai Agassi and the Israeli experiment. There is a lot of evidence to suggest that the next big move is towards the electrification of the auto sector. We need to transform our electrical infrastructure to do that. We need to change our incentive systems and our standards and our regulations. But we can get there. It can benefit everybody. And that's something that historically governments have been pretty good at doing. They are not good at managing companies.
But you were suggesting earlier that if Washington gets involved, gets an ownership stake in the industry as it is, it may actually stand in contradiction to these other goals. If it moves to electrification and Detroit is not set up to follow that move, I mean, you know, maybe Barack Obama's green plans get checked by the government's own stake, very large stake in a very large industry.
Well, I think we have to worry about this becoming a bit of a Trojan horse, where all of a sudden we've got a big stake in an industry that is dependent on bad policies and slow change away from approaches which aren't in the public interest at a moment where we need very rapid change, whether you're looking at it from a climate perspective or you're looking at it from a national security perspective or you're looking at it from an economic perspective. And so you're absolutely right. We've got to focus on making sure that there is not, you know, hidden residual secondary moral hazard built in to this jerry-rigged and not very thoughtful approach to addressing this problem, not solving it, but simply addressing the public outcry that action be taken without actually having the kind of debate and thoughtful analysis that ought to precede writing a check for $50 or $100 billion.
John Paul McDuffie, can you see a government interest in this industry as it is, so working against an Obama administration really pushing a green agenda?
Well, it's certainly possible, but I guess I'm seeing more opportunity for, again, with the financial leverage that the government would have in this using it to produce coordinated action as opposed to, oppositional action. I think a lot of the things that were just suggested as appropriate national policy for future energy, mobility, transportation all make sense. The question is, do you, in the midst of that, take the risk that the domestic industry goes away pretty completely, and also, of course, the risk that we talked about earlier that having that shock hit the economy now would be huge. So, I think part of what's needed here for any prospect of the government role being successful is a clear willingness to get out if it's not working, and a clear willingness to look beyond just managing some of the issues of this one industry to coordinate this with other kinds of national policy.
Of course, the deeper you're in, the harder it can be to get out. And what if there are conflicts there? Let's get a call from Jamestown, Rhode Island, and Robert. Robert, you're on the air.
Hello. We've been hearing a lot in the last few months about companies that are too big to fail, which really means too important to fail for the company as a whole, the country as a whole, the economy as a whole. And I think that if a company is truly too big to fail, that it should be nationalized, at least to some significant extent. And we should leave the marketplace, the free marketplace, or the significantly free marketplace, for those companies to interact who are small enough to fail without injuring the common good, without injuring the public interest.
So you're really describing something more like a European mixed economy here, huge nationalized industries and, the small fries running around and something more freed. Do you think this country can really work with that, Robert?
Well, it is a question of how we see the role of the government. We've traditionally seen the role of the government as number one, protecting the people from foreign attack. And the question beyond that, then, is how much the role of the government is also to protect them from other dangers. We're talking more and more now about environmental dangers. And now the question in this moment in time is economic danger. And so if, now we need to look at how we might re-envision government's role so that economic danger might be mitigated as we go forward.
Yeah, Robert, we've got it. We're re-envisioning at 90 miles an hour here. David Ruthkopf, it leaves my head spinning sometimes. I mean, the thought that, I don't know if we're at the end of the Reagan Revolution or what, with George W. Bush headed up, but at the end of George W. Bush's term, we would see big chunks of Wall Street, the banking industry, and maybe Detroit as well, something like nationalized. This is new turf we're in here, and you hear our callers' willingness to sort of head on in, have a two-tier economy, nationalize wherever we need. Do you think we've got the frame of mind in this country culturally, in economic terms, David, to work with that?
Well, look, I think, first of all, George Bush has done more for nationalization of industry the past year than say, Hugo Chavez has.
Yeah, it's amazing.
This is really new territory. Should the government have a bigger role than it's had? Is the Reagan Revolution over? Yes, and that's a good thing. There are things governments do well. running companies is not one of those things. And so there is a particular problem here. But, you know, we haven't touched upon some of the other problems. We've been going around the world for years saying, don't subsidize your industries. We've created a world trading system that makes it, an offense where you can go and create counter tariffs and other kinds of things when countries subsidize their industries, and now we are doing it.
Subsidize them in much more subtle ways than we're talking about here.
Exactly. And you know, the same is true in the financial sector. We are doing a whole host of things that for the past 20, 30, 50, 60 years, we've been going around the world saying, this is not the kind of behavior that you should do if you want to enter the global economy. And I can imagine that, you know, there are bureaucrats sitting in Beijing right now and sitting in Japan, where we berated them throughout the 90s for their kind of subsidies, either laughing or crying or laughing and crying. And then on top of that, imagine if you're a foreign investor and you want to come and you want to, you know, bring your auto company to the United States. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you're now looking at the U.S. market thinking, not only do I have to compete with successful auto companies like Toyota, Honda, Nissan, BMW, and so forth, but I'm going to have to compete against the U.S. government. How is that going to impact investment flows at precisely the time we need those investment flows?
Wow. We are on a whole new playing field here. Absolutely fascinating. Very grateful to each of you for helping us see the terrain today. David Rothkopf, author of Superclass, these days at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. David, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And John Paul McDuffie, co-director of the International Motor Vehicle Program at MIT, associate professor of management at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. John Paul McDuffie, thank you very much for your time from Philadelphia today.
Thank you, Tom. I enjoyed it.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.